Case number 25-7008 et al. Reinout Akhmetshin, appellant versus William Browder. Mr. Erdelak for the appellant, Mr. Nathan for the appellate.
Good morning, counsel. Don't see you yet, but Mr. Erdelak, whenever you're ready, please proceed.
Good morning, your honors, and may it please the court. Wesley Erdelak on behalf of the appellant Reinout Akhmetshin. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. It is undisputed that Bill Browder went on a nationally televised news program and claimed that Mr. Akhmetshin was, quote, a current spy operator in Washington. The question presented by this appeal is whether or not, having made this false claim in numerous media outlets, Mr. Browder should reasonably expect to be hailed into court in Washington to answer for the truth of those statements and the injury that they caused to my client. Whether this court applies the more flexible Fifth Amendment standard recently announced by the Supreme Court in Fold versus PLO, or the more familiar 14th Amendment minimum contact standard, the answer to that question under this court's precedence is yes. Under the Fifth Amendment, exercising personal jurisdiction over Mr. Browder is reasonable given his substantial ties to the district and the modest burdens that litigating in the district places on a well-resourced individual such as Mr. Browder, who's visited the district countless times voluntarily.
Can we start with the standard, what the standard is, before we dive into whether or not it applies here? So this is the DC courts are set up pursuant to Congress's power over the district, which in one sense is broader than its other unenumerated powers. They basically have a police power over the district, which is why they're setting up local courts to do the general law of torts. But in another sense, it's more limited. So the cases talk about power over the 10 square miles. They analogize Congress when acting pursuant to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 as if it were a state legislature for the district. So given all of that, why wouldn't we apply full-on minimum contacts, which is the test the Supreme Court has said governs for territorially bound states?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the reason is that, as the Supreme Court said in Fold, it really derives from the fact that there is a categorical difference between federal power and state power. And for that reason, when the federal, it's a federal government that is acting when it makes laws for the district. And as the court said in Fold, there really aren't any, or at least it didn't reach the question whether there are any inherent limits on the power of the federal government to exert extraterritorial power.
Yeah, that's true as a general matter. And when Congress is enacting national legislation under the Commerce Clause or exercising foreign affairs powers, as in. Did we lose Judge Pan?
Sorry about that.
No problem.
Technical issue.
Exercise of Fold is an exercise of the foreign affairs power, but this is, again, this is just Congress acting as a state legislature managing local tort law. Just seems very different.
Again, I understand certainly that the strength of the interests of Congress in making law for the district are certainly different. For example, the foreign affairs powers that were involved in the PSJVTA in the Fold case. So I would certainly acknowledge that the strength of the government interests are lesser in this case, and I think that would change the analysis. But I do believe still, if the court did say one thing, it said that there's a categorical difference between Congress and the states. It matters in terms of determining what sort of constraints exist on the exercise of personal jurisdiction. I mean, I think there might be downstream a question of whether exerting jurisdiction to the full extent allowed by the Fifth Amendment comports with the necessary and proper clause. I think that's a more difficult question, but I don't think you need to reach that here. because I think it is clear that there is a more a more relaxed standard that applies under the Fifth Amendment. And I haven't seen the I don't believe Mr. Nathan contests that only the Fifth Amendment applies within the District of Columbia.
So it seems to me that we have precedent directly on point that applies the sort of 14th Amendment minimum context test in the Fifth Amendment context here in the District of Columbia. We held that in an in re sealed case, and the DCCA has also analyzed this directly on point, saying that the minimum context type analysis applies under the Fifth Amendment, even though it originated under the 14th Amendment. And so it seems that when we look at Fold, it would only be if Fold eviscerated or overturned those direct precedents that we would take this path that you're suggesting. And Fold is in such a different context. It's about a statutory grant of jurisdiction. So there's a difference between Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 4K1A, which is what we have been applying, those who are subject to the jurisdiction of a court of general jurisdiction in the state where the district is located, versus 4K1C, which says when authorized by federal statute. So we're looking at two different aspects of applying personal jurisdiction. And then, as you said, we're talking about, a statutory grant in a foreign affairs area. So different. How is it that Fold would eviscerate the on-point precedent that says we should apply minimum context?
Well, Your Honor, I think the reason that I think eviscerate those precedents is I believe that those precedents were decided under the assumption that the standards under the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment were the same. And so I do think the development of a new Supreme Court precedent, which says that these standards are in fact materially different, does change that. And I certainly understand that it's under a different rule.
Well, they held that they were the same in this context. They didn't assume that they're always the same. And the question is why a precedent in a different context would change the analysis under this context.
Only for the reason that they have said that the Fifth Amendment, I don't think when these other cases were considered, there was a signal from the Supreme Court that the difference in the standards was materially different. But I should say, if the court doesn't want to reach the full question, doesn't want to reach the question of whether or not the Fifth Amendment governs here, we are entirely comfortable saying that we think that the allegations in the complaint and the materials submitted to the district court give a very good case that minimum contacts do apply here. Among other things, the fact that in the statement itself that we're alleging is defamatory says that Mr. Akhmetshin is a spy in the district. I think the other side says that the only real as the court below found, I don't think the other side disputes if that claim is somehow intentionally directed towards the district, then jurisdiction is proper here. And the
Before
same.
we get too far into that question, which I am also eager to discuss, at least one more question on the Fold Fifth Amendment versus 14th Amendment question. Which of Congress's enumerated powers do you think it was exercising when it passed the long arm statute? Do you think it was exercising its enclave clause powers to make rules for the district?
Yes, I think it's the enclave powers to make rules for the district.
And then we have precedent that says when Congress does that, it acts in the like manner of the legislature of a state. So why should we, how does that not kind of doom your argument that we need to, apply a broader test than the test that applies to state courts?
I think again, the only reason I would say that it's different is that as the Supreme Court explained in full, there's a categorical difference between state and federal power. So even if the federal government is acting in a like manner as a state, it still has the inherent power to exercise jurisdiction extraterritorially, which is greater than that which is granted to the state legislatures. So
You would agree that Bull didn't discuss territorial courts or DC local courts.
No, Your Honor.
I'm happy for you to move into the argument you were heading towards, unless my colleagues have more
Sure. Yes.
questions on this.
Again, the standard is whether or not Mr. Browder expressly targeted the district. If the statement that our client is a spy in the district isn't enough to, explicitly direct your conduct towards the district, it's very difficult to think of something that does qualify. But even beyond that, even if the court were not to find that the statements themselves set aside minimum context, this is a individual with substantial ties to the district, many, many visits to the district for media appearances, to promote his book, to lobby government. And I would specifically just want to draw attention to one specific incident because I think it's highly probative here and related to the case, which is that in June of 2016, my client made arranged for the screening of a documentary at the museum in Washington, D.C. Mr. Browder subsequently went to several D.C.-based media outlets. This is at pages 136 and 218 of the appendix, and stated that that screening was done at the behest of Russian intelligence. So, again, numerous contexts generally oriented towards burnishing Mr. Browder's reputation as an expert on U.S.-Russia relations. Specific contacts with the district that are involved in fighting with my client and claiming that he is a Russian asset that I think
Are
all.
you currently arguing the Calder effects test or the traditional personal jurisdiction test? I'm trying to understand which argument you're making right now.
I think there is a Calder effects test, which I think is which we believe is satisfied here. And then in addition, other contacts with the district, which I think are more in the species of personal availment, which would also support the
Okay.
exercise
But
of the
the defamation has to arise out of or relate to the contacts. How does that fit?
I would say it relates to the contacts in the sense that the prior contacts that we're pointing to are generally related to Mr. Browder cultivating a career and a reputation as an expert on U.S.-Russia relations, which is the
But
capacity.
isn't the test that he has to reasonably anticipate being hailed into court for the defamatory statements? And these statements were made outside of the district about a meeting in New York. And so I don't, it, the defamation has to relate to the contacts, and I don't see how it does.
As they say, and as I believe Justice Kagan said in the Ford Motor Company, it's arise out of or relate to. I think relate to is meant to encompass a more broad, non-causal relationship between the conflict. I believe the language is that there's some sort of affiliation between the forum and the underlying controversy, and I believe that the underlying
But
controversy.
what's your best argument that these particular statements arise out of or relate to the context in the district?
I would say arise out of or relate to.
Yes, because you've just talked about what the contexts are, but I don't haven't seen the connection yet between the statements and the context.
They're connected in the sense that it was in his capacity as an expert on U.S.-Russia relations that Mr. Browder made the statements. It was the reason why he was brought on national television to make the statements, and it's particularly the reason why the statements about my
But
client.
being an expert is not connected to the district, is it? I mean, he's had some contacts with the district in connection with that, but I'm still not seeing the connection between the specific statements that you allege are defamatory and the contacts with the district.
I believe the connection, or the way I would explain the connection, is that through spending a lot of time in the district, lobbying Congress, making media appearances, he created a status for himself as an expert on U.S.-Russia relations. And were it not for that status, he wouldn't have been someone who appeared on national television to make statements about my client. And he also, the statements wouldn't have had the degree of damage on my client's reputation, if not for those
So is it your position then that
acts.
any comments he makes as an expert on Russian relations, no matter where he makes them and about where he there would be personal jurisdiction in the district?
I don't think I would go that far, but I believe that, in
But
particular.
I don't see how that's different from what you're saying in this particular case, because these statements were not made in the district. They weren't made about events in the district. So it just seems to me you're saying because he has contacts in the district related to his expertise, if he uses that expertise to make comments, there's personal jurisdiction in the district.
Your Honor, I would just want to say two things in response. I realize I'm getting close to the end of my time. First, I would say it is true that the comments were not made in the district, but the cases have never suggested that that question is dispositive. In Calder and also in itself, those statements were made outside the district. They were made from Florida about events that took place in California. And then second, I believe, Your Honor, I don't mean to misquote you, that you said these are not about events that took place in the district.
It was
Again,
a meeting at Trump Tower in New York, was it not?
Yes, Your Honor, but I want to make it clear, we are not claiming that the statements about the Trump Tower meeting are defamatory. My client admits he was at the Trump Tower meeting. We've never at any point suggested that those claims are false. What we claim is that the statement that he made those statements in his capacity as a Russian intelligence asset. And that claim that my client was a Russian intelligence asset is not something that was limited to one particular incident in New York. And in fact, on the face of the
So
very
if he said that in Great Britain, would there be personal jurisdiction here in DC? If he just said that generally in Great Britain?
If he made the same challenge statements from yes, Your Honor, because I believe they were explicitly
And
directed.
if he made them in Russia, if he made them anywhere in the world, there would be personal jurisdiction in DC. Just him saying that your client is a Russian asset gives DC courts personal jurisdiction over him, no matter where he says them?
I believe that the place from what they have said, I mean, it certainly would have some weight if they were made in the district, but I think the general fact that they're made from outside the district is not dispositive. It's a factor. And again, the statement was not just that he was a Russian spy, but literally on the face of the statement, a Russian spy in the district. So that combined with his many other district contacts, I think supports jurisdiction in this case.
Can I ask, you rely primarily on Calder, which is a good case for you, but Walden later seemed to read Calder pretty narrowly, and I wonder what you'd do with that.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree that it's certainly fair to read Walden as trying to pare back some of the more expansive implications of the Calder decision. But what he does say, and I think the most important thing that Justice Thomas says in the decision, is he says that defamation is different from other torts when thinking about these questions of personal jurisdiction. I believe what he says is the crux of Calder is that the reputation-based effects of libel connect the defendant to the forum and not just the plaintiff. And I think that's certainly true here. If you look at the specific features of Calder that Justice Thomas indicated are relevant to the jurisdictional inquiry, I think he says that it's a statement about the district activities. Saying that my client is a spy in the district is a statement about the district activities of a district resident. It caused reputational damage in the district. It was made in media forums that are widely circulated in the district, and it caused injury in the district. So all of the elements that Justice Thomas identified as making jurisdiction proper in Calder, I think, are satisfied here. I think the only, consideration that Justice Thomas identified in Walden as being, relevant to the analysis that we don't have here is the sources that he
Right.
relied upon. And on that, I'd say two things. First is that in his own before the district court, in his briefing, Mr. Browder said that the sources that he relied upon to make the statements were AP news articles and also letters sent to Chuck Grassley. Those news articles are at pages 38 of the appendix, and those are DC-based news articles. And also, Chuck Grassley is obviously located in the district. But I think to the extent that, whether or not jurisdiction is present here relied on factual questions that are not real that are not available to the defendant without the benefit of discovery. I think it would be appropriate to have jurisdictional discovery on that question of where of the basis of the
You
statement.
didn't ask for discovery in connection with this analysis. You had asked for jurisdictional discovery in relation to the long arm statute analysis. So I don't think you can ask for that here, can you?
That is true, Your Honor. We only requested jurisdictional discovery. I guess the only other point I would make that is that if there is a jurisdictional discovery on the constitutional question that would help to, illuminate whether or not there's jurisdiction here, I think it would be fair, to grant.
I think it's forfeited. I think it's waived. You didn't ask for it in the district court. We don't grant that in the first instance here. We're not in the business of granting discovery requests on this court. We review the district court's decision, and you didn't ask the district court.
Mr. Erdelek, on the similarities or differences between our case and Calder, you mentioned that one distinction is the sources. And I know you said you didn't think that distinction was supposed to carry too much weight. I think another distinction is that the Inquirer's largest circulation was in California, and there's nothing to make us think that CBS's largest circulation is in DC. I have another question after that, but do you want to respond on that kind of like detail?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we, I agree. We don't have facts suggesting that DC is the widest audience. I think what Justice Thomas said in Walden is that it was a media forum that was widely circulated in the district. I believe there's allegations on that score in the complaint that they had something like 700,000 viewers in the district, but I can confirm that on rebuttal, Your Honor.
I think along the lines of what Judge Katsas was saying, Calder's a good case for you. It's arguably been read narrowly since then. But even if we take Calder as we find it, it's the high watermark sort of for this theory that you're depending on. So I think you have to be pretty close to on all fours with it. And even if we were to spot you that the sources don't do a lot of work in distinguishing it, and even if we were to spot you that the largest circulation versus a merely large circulation distinction doesn't do a lot of work, I think you're left having to show that the sort of the conduct defamed here, allegedly, is similar to the conduct allegedly defamed there. And in our case, you've got a 6-minute interview that's primarily focused on a meeting in New York. It does mention your client and does say that your client is operating in DC. But that is about as fleeting as a reference can be. And I went back and looked at the Shirley Jones article in Calder, and by my count, every or almost every paragraph of that article, and there's about 12 paragraphs, talks about California. In the first paragraph, it talks about insiders who are in California. In the second, it says Hollywood. The third, it talks about a new TV show, which I assume was in California. The third talks about inside sources who visited the set and crew members, presumably all in California. Fifth paragraph talks about the crew. Sixth paragraph talks about shooting the show. Seventh paragraph talks about Hollywood and talks about her home in California. Eighth paragraph talks about the set. Ninth paragraph talks about former staffers. Tenth paragraph talks about a former employee. 11th paragraph talks about another former employee. 12th mentions Hollywood. 13th mentions a casting couch in Hollywood. 14th mentions a movie in Hollywood. 15th mentions the casting couch again. 16th mentions a TV program in Hollywood. 17th mentions the Hollywood industry. 18th mentions a former associate in Hollywood. 19th mentions people who work in Hollywood. And the 20th mentions the movie industry in Hollywood. I mean, to have 20 paragraphs, each of them mentioning California or alluding to California in 20 out of 21 paragraphs just seems a lot different than like 3 seconds in a 6-minute interview that mentioned Washington once.
Your Honor, of course, I wouldn't claim that the statements that we're challenging here are as focused on the forum as obviously an article that is entirely about California. But again, I want to emphasize we're not basing our defamation claim on any of the other statements, about the Trump Tower meeting. Really, the only defamation that we're the basis of the defamation claim is the claim that Mr. Akhmetshin is a Russian spy, which is not a claim that is limited in time and space to one particular incident in New York. It's related to his general activities. And again, we're focusing on the statement. I understand the focus on the statement and whether that by itself is sufficient to support jurisdiction under Walden and Calder. And I certainly welcome those questions, but I do want to again emphasize this is a client, this is a defendant who has many, many contacts in Washington. Aside from the museum example I gave, he also submitted a FARA complaint against my client in July of 2016, just months after making the museum. And I think it's fair to say that those specific contacts relate to the instant dispute and that the previous.
I take that argument, and it may or may not be a winning argument. I think when you said what happened here was not as focused on DC as the Jones article was focused on California, though, that makes it really hard to rely on Calder because Calder is the high watermark. So you've got to be at least as focused on DC as Calder was focused on California, or else that outlier case, I think, isn't going to be able to do the work that you need it to do.
Your Honor, again, I think that the rule that has come out of Calder is whether the offending statements are focused on the district. I do think a statement that on the face of it says your client is a spy in Washington, which is really the only thing we're alleging is defamatory here.
Your theory is this focused on the district because the statements go to just how your client does his work as a lobbyist, and he lobbies in the district. But boy, in a world where tweets go across the globe just automatically, someone tweets a statement that another individual is a, corrupt, fill in the blank, lobbyist, lawyer, bad doctor, whatever. That person can sue in his home forum on the theory that the communication makes its way into the forum, hurts the defendant in a more focused way in the forum, and is sort of necessarily targeted at what the defendant is doing primarily in the forum. I mean, then we're back to Judge Pan's point about you could have made the statement in Moscow or London or Hawaii or wherever.
Your Honor, I just would say two things. Again, I don't think the cases have ever suggested that the place from which the defendant made the statements plays a particularly large role in the jurisdictional analysis, to Judge Pan's point. But on the first point about whether or not,
No, but there no contact made from a remote place with no contact to the forum, other than that the statement is saying something derogatory about the professional activities of the defendant.
I would say yes, Your Honor. And the reason is that,
Okay.
as Justice Thomas said in Walden v. Fiore, I think the way that Justice Thomas narrowed Calder in a way to be consistent with the way the court came out in Walden v. Fiore was, I think, large part driven by taking on a very distinctive analysis of defamation as a tort, saying that defamation as a tort is different from other torts because it has an element of publication. The publication within the forum being a necessary element of the claim ties the defendant to the forum in a way that is different from other types of intentional torts. So I do think that would be consistent with what Justice Thomas said in Walden v.
And
Fiore.
what's your best case post Walden that would support a theory like that?
Post Walden.
Yeah.
I give me a second, Your Honor.
Okay, well, you can give it to me on rebuttal if you want, or we'll check your brief, but I am not aware of a lot of such cases. So anyway,
Thank you, Your Honor.
do you have anything else? Do my colleagues have any other
Yeah,
questions?
I just have one quick question.
Oh, go ahead.
Could you have sued in New York?
It's a good question. I think we might have sued in New York. I believe, given the conduct of Mr. Browder in D.C., it certainly made sense to sue in D.C., given the fact that that was also where my client suffered the injury, where the reputational damage occurred. Given the fact that the statements were made in connection or in relationship to an interview that was about the D.C. meeting, I think we could have sued in D.C. as well.
Judge Pan?
Or I'm
Yes,
sorry, in New York.
thank
I'm sorry, Your Honor, in New
you.
York.
If I may, I just wanted to follow up on your colloquy with Judge Cassis, which I thought was very illuminating. Is it then your position that any plaintiff in a defamation case can sue in the jurisdiction where that plaintiff resides because the plaintiff has been harmed in that jurisdiction because that's where that plaintiff lives and works, and therefore the reputational harm, et cetera, is centered and targeted in that jurisdiction.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. If I said that was enough, I apologize. I think
It
initially
sounded that way
that.
to me.
Sorry.
What
So
else
to
is
clarify.
required?
Yeah, to me too.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. To clarify, I think in addition to that, you would need allegations that, in addition to reputational harm, that again, the media, the statements were made on media, forms of media that were widely circulated in the district. And I think some future statements
In
that.
this case, they were media that were circulated everywhere. So there was nothing special about the district in terms of the media. It was just national media outlets. So I'm still struggling to understand what connects the district to this set of facts in a way that other jurisdictions would not be.
Yes, Your Honor.
The main thing is your client's presence in the District of Columbia and the reputational harm here. And I'm just trying to understand what, in addition, is necessary.
Yes, Your Honor. Again, as I read Walden, I think that is the plaintiff's suffering injury and reputational harm. The district is the primary consideration. In addition, I would say again, wide circulation in the district, and then also some feature of the statements that gives them a district focus, which we think is met here by the fact that they are claiming that my
So
client is
just the
close
statement that
by
he
and.
said that your client is in Washington is enough. Because in terms of the media outlets, the district is no different from Oklahoma or New York or wherever that Twitter and CBS News reaches. So there's nothing special about the district in terms of the media outlet. So then all I hear is that the statement was that your client is a spy in Washington, but that's just a statement of his location, which is still the same question. It's his location. Is your client's location in DC enough to provide that hook for personal jurisdiction? It seems like that's your position.
Again, I think the fact that the on the face of the statements it explicitly says that my client is a spy in Washington is suffices to give the statements a Washington focus, which again is what Justice Thomas identified in Walden
So that's
as.
the key fact to you. That's the factor on which you hang your argument, just the fact that they said a spy in Washington, which is physically where your client is.
Again, if we're only looking at the statements, then yes, I think that is the feature that gives them a Washington focus. But again, we also think that there are other contacts with the district which support jurisdiction here.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Do my colleagues have any other questions? Okay, we'll give you rebuttal time and opposition time on the cross appeal. Thank you, Mr. Erdelak.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Nathan.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Aaron Nathan, and I represent the appellee and cross-appellant William Browder. The appellant's theory of personal jurisdiction in this case would subject Mr. Browder to jurisdiction anytime he speaks about Mr. Akhmetshin from anywhere in the world, apparently or seemingly for all time, whether under Calder or whether under the more traditional minimum contacts or relatedness standard. It appears that Mr. Browder is simply stuck with Mr. Akhmetshin and the District of Columbia if he ever chooses to speak about him anywhere in the future. I think that violates the fundamental principles enunciated in Ford that the relatedness requirement exists to give a defendant fair notice of when a particular activity can subject the defendant to litigation in a particular forum. And that exists so that the defendant can take measures to structure his primary conduct to avoid or mitigate the consequences of jurisdiction, including, and Ford makes reference to this, by purchasing insurance, which may or may not apply in all cases, or even by severing ties with the forum to avoid jurisdiction here. Mr. Akhmetshin's theories just do not leave those options open to Mr. Browder. Now, there's been some discussion of the sources for Mr. Browder's statements. In relation to the plaintiff's Calder theory here, I think it's important to note that there actually is record evidence of what this, I shouldn't use the term evidence, but there is material in the record that shows what Mr. Browder's sources were. Mr. Browder's very first statement that is challenged in this case was a tweet in which he shared or retweeted an NBC News article about the plaintiff. The article was titled, "Former Soviet counterintelligence officer at meeting with Donald Trump Jr. and Russian lawyer." In the body of that article, The article described Mr. Akhmetshin as a former Soviet counterintelligence officer who is suspected by some US officials of having ongoing ties to Russian intelligence. Now, that was in the very first tweet that Mr. Browder sent relating to this controversy. Subsequent statements relied on that information, also on the Associated Press. And by the way, that's at Joint Appendix 38. That subsequent statements relied on both that information and the Associated Press article that my friend referred to before, in which Mr. Akhmetshin served as a primary on-the-record source about the details of the Trump Tower meeting and confirmed his own connections to a Russian military unit that he described in an on-the-record quote as, quote, loosely
I guess,
part of
Mr. Chairman,
counterintelligence.
is this all about the merits, or are you still making are you making an argument about specific jurisdiction?
Well, my hook, certainly for bringing that up, was that my friend on the other side was trying to defend the absence of allegations about the sources for Mr. Browder's statements as still somehow justifying a Calder theory. I'm just making the point that, in fact, there is information in the record about what Mr. Browder's sources were. They were the news articles that he woke up and read in New York on the day
Let's
that he made the first statements.
focus on the contacts to DC. Mean, the theory of personal jurisdiction is it's expansive, it's worrisome for reasons we explored with your friend, but the gist of the defamatory statements, it has nothing to do with the fact of a meeting at Trump Tower in New York, and everything to do with the allegation that Akhmetshin is a Russian operative. And this is all in the context where the two antagonists are fighting over legislation that one of them has supported vigorously, and the other is supporting a repeal. And that is all necessarily DC focused conduct aimed at Congress. And so the statement, you know, that this guy who's lobbying against me on the other side should not be credited because he's a Russian operative, seems pretty DC focused in a way that a lot of other defamatory statements, you know, this guy's a crook or whatever, are not.
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to be clear about what the record actually is in this case. The statements at issue were made in July 2017. The first Magnitsky Act was enacted in 2012. The follow-on statute was enacted in December 2016. The complaint alleges that, well, virtually all but one of the contacts that are alleged in the complaint have nothing to do with Mr. Akhmetshin. On their face, they don't mention him, they don't relate to him. They do relate to Mr. Browder's longstanding advocacy in the district relating to the Magnitsky Act. But the complaint also alleges that Mr. Akhmetshin joined that debate at some point in 2016, after virtually every one of the contacts on which jurisdiction is alleged here. So what we're dealing with is
Sorry,
two, excuse me.
are the contested statements, the tweets? I have two tweets, a Business Insider comment and a CBS comment. Are those after Akhmetshin has weighed in on the statute?
They are after Mr. Akhmetshin alleges that he commenced a lobbying campaign relating to the statute. That's correct. They are also after virtually all of the contacts that Mr. Browder made in the district relating to the statute. And I hasten to emphasize the contacts that are alleged only relate to the statute. The only one that even mentions Mr. Akhmetshin is the Hermitage letter to the DOJ FARA unit. And the status of that contact, as we discuss in our briefs, is contested. It's our position that those contacts can't be attributed to Mr. Browder and that appellant actually waives his opportunity to make a contrary argument in this appeal. But the point is only that Mr. Browder had completed most of, if not all of, the Magnitsky Act-related contacts by the time Mr. Akhmetshin even joined the debate over the Magnitsky Act.
Put
So,
those aside for a second, where you have a pretty good argument on lack of relatedness. I'm just focused on the statements, the four statements that are not just related to, they are the basis for the claim. And I'm just exploring with you, just as to those statements, we take the complaint, take the allegations in the complaint, we assume them to be true. We charitably read the complaint within the bounds of reasonableness. And all I'm asking you to focus on is these statements are made in a context where the two parties are at odds over whether the statute should be repealed.
I'm sure, Your Honor. So, with respect to
And in that context, there see maybe is a greater focus or concentration or directedness vis-a-vis the district.
Well, I'll take the question first under relatedness. If you're interested in my views as concerns the Calder theory, I'm happy to address that as well. But I understand you to be asking
Now,
for
listen,
this.
I'm more interested in Calder.
Okay.
Well, relatedness of the statements to the district, not the other stuff that.
In the sense of the statements being whatever it is that Calder would require them to be targeted at, or and so forth. Yes.
Yeah, something like that.
The problem with that theory is that three of the statements don't mention the district at all. One of them does it, but it merely mentions the district. So even just right off the bat, mentioning is not the same thing as targeting. It's not the same thing as purposefully availing oneself of the privileges, of conducting business in the district. Those are all begin fairly far afield from traditional notions of due process and fair play and the considerations that are at play here. The reason they can't satisfy Calder is, I think, and has been discussed by the panel already, Calder represents the high watermark of a relatively unusual fount of personal jurisdiction. It's not unusual for plaintiffs to be sued. Excuse me. There are a simpler way of saying it is probably that there are ways to sue defendants who make statements in most cases. The traditional way is to sue them in their home jurisdiction or in somewhat less usual cases in the jurisdiction where they engage in the conduct in question. And then Calder often creates a third option that's even more exceptional, and usually that ends up founding jurisdiction in the plaintiff's home state. That's only permissible where the factors enunciated in Calder are met. Anything less than that would end up extending Calder in a way that I'm not sure that any cases subsequent to Calder have done. Another reason, actually, that this would be an extension.
What's the most important distinction in your view?
Well, I.
Assuming we're reading it narrowly and looking for colorable distinctions, what's your best one?
Well,
So the first one I
I
noticed
hate to
was the first
choose.
one I noticed was the phone calls into California, and that's not present here, but that seems a little precious to me.
Right.
So what else do we have?
Well, I don't want to run away from the point that future cases need to be on all fours with Calder in order to satisfy the test, and this one isn't. But accepting that you want a little bit more than that, Calder and Walden, subsequent to Calder, talks about the story in Calder. The focal point of the story was the forum, not just the plaintiff, right? So it's not just that. The defendants did XYZ. It's that the statements themselves had a focal point and, excuse me, a forum as a focal point. Now, many statements will not have any forum as their focal point. Some will have more than one. But here, to the extent that the statements had any focal point at all, it's the forum that the statements were about. To go lower on the list risks expanding Calder into a sort of a more creative use of effects-based jurisdiction than I think the Calder Court or the Walden Court or this court in subsequent cases has ever really entertained. I would also just emphasize that Walden itself, although Walden's gloss on Calder is a little bit hard to read in some ways, Walden speaks of the connections that the defendant made with the defendants made with California, and says that it was only in addition to that, because the focal point of the story was also California, that jurisdiction was proper in that case. If the
My
court
colleagues have no other questions, we'll let you move on to the cross appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Our argument in the cross appeal is quite simple. No one is contesting that Abbas and Ta correctly state the law, as the Supreme Court recently clarified.
Can I ask you a preliminary question, though? If we think there's no personal jurisdiction, we can't reach your anti-SLAPP Act issue, correct? So if there's no personal jurisdiction, we can't get to the merits, and this is grounded in the merits, right?
No, respectfully, Your Honor, we disagree with that position. We've explained why in our papers, but the language of the D.C. statute is that the claim has to be likely to succeed on the merits. Now, of course, that can mean many different things. It can mean things that can't be applied in federal
I have
court.
A different, I mean, regardless of what the statute says, it just seems to me that if we find there's no personal jurisdiction, we don't go any further.
Well, if there's no personal jurisdiction, you can't go any further with respect to my client. But the plaintiff has, I think, indisputably submitted himself to the jurisdiction of DC courts for purposes of, you know, whatever, however you want to characterize it, a counterclaim or a motion to dismiss with a prevailing party, you know, fee shifting provision attached to it. I don't think there's, I'm not aware of, I'm happy to address it again on rebuttal or submit a letter to the court if there's a more particular question, but I'm not aware of the other side making any argument that they're immune from the consequences of the anti-SLAPP law simply because of the, you know, because of our argument that there's no personal jurisdiction over Mr. Browder. They have made the argument that the DC anti-SLAPP law only shifts fees where the dismissal is on the merits. We think that's wrong for a few reasons. One of them is that, of course, as everybody knows, personal jurisdiction is a prerequisite to the merits. So if a plaintiff can't assert personal jurisdiction successfully, by definition, that plaintiff is also not likely to succeed on the merits in that litigation. There's another statutory feature of the Anti-SLAPP Act that I think confirms this. One of them, one of its provisions says that dismissals under the statute shall be with prejudice. Now, that's probably preempted by Federal Rule 41, but as a matter of statutory interpretation, there would be no reason to say that if the dismissals under the Anti-SLAPP Act could only be on the merits, because DC's equivalent, parallel Rule 41, just like the Federal Rule 41, says that unless the court orders otherwise, dismissals operate as an adjudication on the merits. So that's a further reason why we think that the DC Anti-SLAPP Act applies
but
here.
We can't, I'm sorry, I'm just confused by this, because I don't think we can get to the fee issue without addressing the question of whether there was a likelihood of success in the merits, right? Isn't that the whole point of the anti-SLAPP special motion that gives rise to the fee shifting?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if we can't address the merits because there's no personal jurisdiction, I just don't understand how we get there.
Well, what you need to address is whether the plaintiff is likely to succeed on the merits. And if the plaintiff can't successfully assert personal jurisdiction, then the
no,
answer
I
is
understand
no.
That. I'm just having trouble with the notion that there's no personal jurisdiction, but we're going to go on to assess whether there's a likelihood of success in the merits in the context of the fee shifting. To me, that there's a disconnect, because I thought if there's no personal jurisdiction, we're done. Like, you can make alternative arguments to dismiss before the district court, but the preliminary one is personal jurisdiction. And if you win, we're done. And it seems to me that if you want to pursue anti-SLAPP, you could have consented to jurisdiction and litigated the anti-SLAPP special motion stuff, or tried to. But since you asserted the personal jurisdiction, and if you win, it seems to me that you don't get to go to anti-SLAPP, because you're not consenting to the personal jurisdiction for us to get to the merits, or for the district court to get to the merits.
That's correct, Your Honor. Although where I think we part ways is that I don't think that the court would have to say anything about the merits of Mr. Akhmetshin's allegations or apply the law of defamation to those allegations in order to grant our anti-SLAPP motion. All the court needs
How?
to
How? Because
Well,
don't we have to
here's
show likelihood of success in the merits?
And all the court needs to do to say that there is no likelihood of success on the merits, zero, in fact, is come to the conclusion that because there's no personal jurisdiction over the defendant, the court cannot even
That's really bootstrapping. That's saying if you get dismissal based on no personal jurisdiction, you get fees. It's just there's a big leap there, isn't there?
Well,
In
that's
general,
the
that's not the relief for a lack of personal jurisdiction. You don't get fees. It's a big deal
No,
to get
that's
fees.
it's none of this is the usual remedy or the usual relief. This is just what the DC Council enacted in the Anti-SLAPP Act, and it attached consequences to the bringing
So
of
I guess
meritless
though,
litigation. Yeah.
that the issue is. You're saying that you should win on the anti-SLAPP fees petition because there's no personal jurisdiction. But to even get to the anti-SLAPP fees issue, it seems that there needs to be personal jurisdiction. That's my concern.
We're saying that granting our motion to dismiss on any grounds that are raised in this appeal entitles my client to fees because it entails that the other side could not have prevailed, was never likely to succeed,
Does
had
that
no
mean that in
likelihood of
any
success.
defamation case, that in any defamation case where there's a dismissal for lack of personal jurisdiction, you get fees? The plaintiff gets fees?
To the extent the other provisions of the Anti-SLAPP Act are satisfied, yes, that
But
is
then you've
what.
got to look at the other provisions of the Anti-SLAPP Act, which we can't do if there's no personal jurisdiction, right?
Well, you don't have
Otherwise,
to look at
you're
all
just
of.
trying to attach fees to any dismissal for lack of personal jurisdiction in an anti-def in a defamation case.
All that applying the any the, which provisions of the Anti-SLAPP Act apply in any given case is going to vary depending on the circumstances. That's one of the arguments we've made about why parts of it can apply even when other parts of it are preempted by a valid
But if
federal
we're
rule.
looking at it, we
But
have to have jurisdiction, right?
if you're look, all you have to do, well, I think our position here is simply that looking at what the anti-SLAPP statute says, applying its terms to the allegations in this case is entirely permissible in the context of evaluating the plaintiff's own violation of what the anti-SLAPP statute forbids, which is bringing a meritless SLAPP suit or a SLAPP suit that's not likely to succeed
No,
on the
I understand
merits.
your
So I
position.
agree that you.
I just don't understand how that works with the fact that there has to be personal jurisdiction for us to move to the next step.
I'm not sure it
And
would be
otherwise,
any.
it seems to me, if you're just relying on the fact that if there's a dismissal for lack of personal jurisdiction, then it seems like you're just saying in any defamation case where there's a dismissal for lack of personal jurisdiction, there will be fee shifting. And I
I'm
just
not
can't
sh
imagine that's how it works. I think you have to look at the merits to get to that stage. And I don't think we can look at the merits if there's no personal jurisdiction.
Well, you have to look at the merits in the sense that you have to look at the allegations in the complaint and make a conclusion about whether they qualify for the treatment that the anti-SLAPP statute provides for SLAPP claims. So yes, it needs to be a petition involving public participation and so forth. But I don't see how that's any different than a district court reviewing for example, a Rule 11 motion attacking the frivolousness of a pleading in a context where it so happens that in addition to being frivolous on the merits, there was no personal jurisdiction over the defendant. I think a district court's fully empowered to review the allegations of the complaint and reach that conclusion, even if it's also reached the conclusion that the defendant wasn't subject to personal jurisdiction in the first place. It's just that the anti-SLAPP analysis, just like that one, is a
But in
plaintiff-focused
assessing that
analysis.
in that situation, they don't have to look at the merits of the case.
Well, I
Well,
think
I guess not to the same extent
they
in terms of
right. I mean, I
likelihood of
think you
success.
stop a little short of deciding whether it states a claim for relief. I agree with that. But I don't think you have to get that far either, because all we're saying is that failure to establish personal jurisdiction entails that there's no likelihood of success on the merits. You don't actually have to look at whether or not Mr. Akhmetshin's allegations state a claim for relief, only whether, as alleged, they qualify as.
I understand, but
I'm
then we
not.
are in the position that every defamation case means there's fee shifting. Every
Every.
defamation case that's dismissed for lack of personal jurisdiction, there would be fee shifting under anti-SLAPP.
If filed in DC and if the DC anti-SLAPP, if it falls within the definition of a SLAPP lawsuit under DC law, that, yes, that is our position, to be clear. And that's what the DC Council intended, to shift the risk of bringing litigation that ultimately has no likelihood of or is not likely to succeed on the merits to the plaintiff. and to deter for either meritless, frivolous lawsuits or lawsuits that just should never have been brought in this jurisdiction in the first place, which I think, as this litigation shows, can do just as much damage and involve just as much, delay and wasteful litigation as lawsuits that spend 8 years litigating the merits as opposed to personal jurisdiction, as in this situation.
I realize that American studies and competitive enterprises v. Mann are relatively recent, and you think that they have kind of unsettled where the circuit was before. But since Abbas, has any DC Circuit panel granted an anti-SLAPP motion?
No, Your Honor, we are asking this panel to recognize something that this court has yet to recognize, which is that contrary to the assumptions about DC law that the Abbas panel relied on, the DC anti-SLAPP statute actually operates in some ways that, yes, are incompatible with federal diversity litigation because the federal rules grant them, but in other ways that are not. And when the DC Anti-SLAPP Act can operate in a way that's not preempted by the federal rules, we think that Supreme Court precedent requires the federal courts to apply it and allow it to operate in those ways. So here we have a situation where nobody had to do anything that was foreign to the procedures of federal litigation in order to come to the conclusion that the complaint had to be dismissed. It turns out that in that situation, DC law attaches a fee-shifting remedy. That's the end of the story as far as we're concerned. And it doesn't make any difference that in another case, perhaps there might have been arguments about whether a discovery stay applied if this case had been brought in DC state court, in DC Superior Court. There would have been a stay of discovery. There would have been expedited hearing on the motion. There might have been other procedural requirements, as I alluded to before. Dismissal would have had to have been with prejudice. None of those things could have happened in federal court, but the fact is that they didn't. And DC law still requires a fee-shifting remedy in that situation. It's our submission that to ignore that aspect of DC law as it currently operates would be tantamount to imposing a sort of statutory drafting requirement on
What
state
if,
legislatures.
I mean, it strikes me as you're talking that this may not comport with the policies behind the Anti-SLAPP Act. The Anti-SLAPP Act is intended to discourage sort of vexatious litigation, filing defamation claims in order to harass another person. So what if it's a meritorious claim on the merits, but there's no personal jurisdiction because they filed in the wrong place?
Yeah, the consequence of that is fee shifting. And the reason is that the Anti-SLAPP Act is meant to deter vexatious litigation,
But I'm just
not
saying
just
it's not
to.
vexatious. What if it's completely meritorious, but they made a mistake and filed in the wrong jurisdiction?
Well, a plaintiff who makes a mistake might be in a more sympathetic position, but plaintiffs can
But
act vexatiously.
your position would affect the person who made a mistake and had a meritorious claim and
Yes,
just
because
filed in the wrong
sometimes.
place.
Yes, because the Anti-SLAPP Act engages in general as well as specific deterrence, and
I'm just
sometimes
saying,
that.
but the Anti-SLAPP Act doesn't specifically deal with this scenario, but you want to extend it to a scenario which might not promote the policies behind the Anti-SLAPP Act.
I think that the Anti-SLAPP Act deals with this scenario explicitly by providing that a SLAPP claim has to be dismissed if it's not likely to succeed on the merits. Plenty of claims that are eventually meritorious do not appear likely at the pleading stage. And, ordinarily in federal court, that's not a basis for dismissal, even if a savvy judge thinks that a plaintiff's not going to succeed if the 12b6 standard is satisfied, the claims go forward. That's a reason that the likelihood of success standard as
All
an.
I'm saying is I think that the purpose behind the Anti-SLAPP Act and its focus on merits, likelihood of success in the merits, suggests that they might not have contemplated, a meritorious claim. This is just my hypothetical, being brought, and there's a mistake, they filed in the wrong place, and there wasn't personal jurisdiction, and there should be fee shifting in that context, because it's not the kind of vexatious litigation that the Anti-SLAPP Act is intended to address. It's just in the wrong forum.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think it's a mistake to conclude or to infer that it's only actually vexatious litigation that ends up subject to the fee-shifting remedies of the Anti-SLAPP Act. I mean, almost
No,
as
I
a,
understand. You're just asking
yeah.
for an extension of it. It's not clear to me that the policy reasons behind it support the extension.
No, I think in the core applications of the Anti-SLAPP Act, it will sometimes be the case that a plaintiff with a claim that would otherwise ultimately prove to be meritorious has their complaint dismissed under the Anti-SLAPP Act because it's not likely to succeed at the pleading stage. And
Can
that's
you give
one
me an
reason why
example
that
of that?
standard.
Can you just give me a concrete example of a situation where you're not likely to succeed, but then you ultimately prevail on the merits?
Well, likely to, this is the whole reason why the likelihood of that likely to succeed standard can't apply in federal court, to its
Just give me
fullest
like a
extent,
factual
because
scenario in which somebody's
of
not likely to succeed at this stage, but then they ultimately do succeed at the end. Because those are supposed to run together.
no, well, no, I would submit that they're not. I think that's why
Okay, give me an example.
the
Okay, give me an
plausibility standard
example.
at the 12B6 stage
Give me
is
a
just
factual
less.
scenario that's an example of something that seems not likely to succeed in the merits at this stage, but is ultimately meritorious.
I apologize. Sort of my mind is a blank on that, but I think it's the reality that the plausibility standard only looks to what a plaintiff is able to allege, and then merits adjudications look to what a plaintiff's able to prove after discovery. And it seems plain to me that sometimes plaintiffs who don't have access to all the evidence at the pleading stage are just not in as strong a position to allege the case. And yet, because the 12B6 standard is more forgiving, assumes their allegations to be true, draws inferences in their favor, are able to get past that stage, even though if the likelihood of success, well, I mean, just to take another tack at it, likelihood of success is at least analogous to the preliminary injunction stage. And it's frequently the case that a claim isn't likely to succeed on the merits at the pleading stage, even though it still survives a 12B6 motion. That strikes me as a straightforward occurrence under, or at least it's the way the rules are structured in federal court. It's also, I mean, just to return to the point about the purposes of the anti-SLAPP statute, it may be a regrettable consequence, but it is the policy choice that the DC Council made that in order to deter vexatious and frivolous litigation, it had to draw the circle a little bit wider and end up attaching fee-shifting remedies to some plaintiffs who, if things had gone otherwise, if they had, access to a little bit more information at the time they filed their lawsuit, they might have prevailed, but couldn't and didn't, and therefore, because they weren't able to show that they were likely to succeed on the merits at the pleading stage, they have to pay the fees. And the anti-SLAPP statute's purpose is simply to shift the burden, the risk of that outcome to the plaintiff rather than the SLAPP defendant. It's confined to an area of litigation where the DC Council, I think, had not just reasonable but powerful reasons to worry about defendants who've engaged in protected activity, whether under the First Amendment or just consistent with First Amendment values, and are instead sort of, as punishment for that, held into court and then forced to bear the burdens, not just of losing litigation, but of litigation itself. And I think all of that points to a rule that includes dismissals for personal jurisdiction, because the plaintiff should have to bear the risk of making a mistake in that area as well. It's just an exception to the American rule in a very tightly circumscribed category of cases. It works like this in other countries, and there's nothing particularly anomalous about it. Judge Walker asked this question of my friend before, but I can't think of a reason why this litigation could not have been brought in New York as opposed to in DC. There were other options available to this plaintiff. By the way, this plaintiff's merits claims are not meritorious. And while there may be sympathetic plaintiffs out there who will get, caught up in this, and we can worry about their cases when it arises, this just isn't one of those cases. And I don't think the court should hesitate to read DC law the way the DC Court of Appeals reads it, apply Supreme Court precedent on the Erie Hanna Rules Enabling Act, Rules of Decision Act, and grant the fee shifting remedy that we've requested.
Mr. Nathan,
Mr.
you're. Oh, Judge Walker, do you have questions?
Nathan. No, please, Judge
Go
Cassis,
ahead.
if you were going
No,
to.
I was going to cut off the advocate pending any of my colleagues' questions. Go ahead.
I do have one or two. Someone is entitled to anti-SLAPP money when they prevail on a motion brought under 16-5502. And you haven't prevailed on a motion brought under 16-5502. So why is it this is not just sort of like textualism 101? Is that just kind of too literal or?
It's both, well, it's true the district court denied the motion. We're saying the district court should have granted it, and you need to reverse the denial of that motion. But it's also a little too literal, both as a matter of DC law and as a matter of the way the federal and DC rules are written. Under 16.5502 just doesn't necessarily mean including all the possible bases for dismissal under 16.5502. It, I think, is more fairly read to mean under any of the possible bases for dismissal, which include, as the American Studies Court has held, a dismissal for failure to state a claim under sort of ordinary plausibility pleading rules. So that's one textual answer. The other one, which we have in a footnote in our briefs, but which I want to emphasize here, is that the rule in federal court is that all relief is sought by motion. That's Rule 7. There is no motion under any particular state statute in federal court under any circumstances, even in ones where it's just obvious that the state statute applies. You seek relief in federal court by filing a motion under Rule 7. By the way, it's the same in DC Superior Court. You file a motion under Rule 7, at least in the strictest, most technical sense, and you ask for relief based on the application of some substantive law. Here, that's the provisions of 16.5504 that attach consequences to the dismissal of an anti-SLAPP motion where you have a failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted.
Okay, that's helpful.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Nathan. We will give you some rebuttal time on the
Thank you,
cross
Your Honor.
appeal. Back to Mr. Erdelak.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to make a few points. There was a colloquy with my friend discussing Mr. Browder's contacts with the district. The colloquy is mostly focused on how the instant suit relates to Browder's work in the district lobbying for the Magnitsky Act. Again, just want to make it clear that in addition to those specific contacts related to the Magnitsky Act, again, Mr. Browder gave interviews with DC-based media outlets concerning a screening of a documentary at the museum, which was formerly in DC, that Mr. Akhmetshin arranged, and a group that Mr. Akhmetshin was involved with arranged to screen that documentary at the museum. And in those specific media outlets, Mr. Browder claimed that the screening at the museum was done at the behest of Russian intelligence. And in fact, in a FARA complaint that he submitted to submitted to Congress the following month, that specific museum screening was in fact mentioned in the FARA complaint as another instance in which Mr. Akhmetshin had served as a on behalf of Russian intelligence. So those contacts, which again are just a prior chapter of the current controversy that we see now, where Mr. Browder has accused my client of being a Russian spy and done so in order to protect his reputation in relationship to Magnitsky, I think does relate to the current suit. And Judge Katz.
The statements you just mentioned, though, are not the four that form the basis for this claim, correct?
No, Your Honor, these are other district activities that support the exercise of jurisdiction related to that statement.
So you have greater degree of targeting, but tougher case on relatedness.
I think it's fair to say that they're related in the sense that they are, there's an affiliation between these prior acts that Mr. Browder undertook in the district and the current controversy between the two claimants, including essentially an identity of the insinuations about my client. There are previous occasions in which Mr. Browder has said Akhmetshin is a spy. He's a spy in Washington, D.C., and specifically enumerated instances that took place in the district where Mr. Akhmetshin was acting as a spy and in news outlets that are located in D.C. Both of the news outlets and the two media articles that gave related to this are in D.C. One other point just on Calder. Just to make it clear, so there were two defendants in Calder about the facts, and I want to make it clear that one of the defendants, Calder himself, was in fact not the reporter that created the article or reached out into California for sources in the article. Mr. Calder's only involvement in the article at all was that he edited the article and that he refused a request on behalf of Ms. Jones to retract the article and had no other relevant contacts at all with California. And jurisdiction was found to be proper under those facts. And just finally, on the question about whether or not on the anti-SLAPP issue, as I understand, the other side has, I don't think, no longer maintains that the DC SLAPP Act special motion to dismiss procedure can apply in federal court. And just to make it clear, it can apply in federal court because, as the Supreme Court just ruled in Bok v. Choi, the DC anti-SLAPP Act special motion to dismiss procedure answers the same question as the federal rule. So it can apply in federal court. He can't bring a motion under that provision in federal court. And as Judge Walker pointed out, Section 5504A says that you may receive fees if you prevail on an action under 5502. So I don't understand how they could possibly claim that they are entitled to fees based on success on a motion that cannot be brought in federal court.
And I'm not saying I agree with him, but Mr. Nathan's response was he says he should have prevailed on that motion. And I think I understand you to be saying, look, at least part of the Anti-SLAPP Act is clearly preempted. So that means that all of the Anti-SLAPP Act is preempted. And I guess my first question is, does the Anti-SLAPP Act have a severability clause or an anti-severability clause? I don't think it does, but you can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
I'm not sure off the top of my head, Your Honor, and you can certainly ask my my other side, but I
I
think
mean, assume.
yeah, sorry.
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
But again, you don't it's not necessary to resolve this question to claim that the entire Anti-SLAPP Act is preempted. I think the only thing that you would need to find is that specifically the section of the Anti-SLAPP Act that does conflict with the federal rules, which is 5502 and its special motion to dismiss procedure, that cannot apply in federal court. And because, again, you wouldn't need to find that the fee shifting provision is, not applicable in federal court. All you would need to find is that the fee shifting provision explicitly ties the availability of fees to success under another provision of the DC Anti-SLAPP Act that I think undisputedly cannot apply.
Do you have a position on how this anti-SLAPP Act motion relates to the lack of personal jurisdiction motion? Like, if we find there's no personal jurisdiction, can we even reach the anti-SLAPP Act issue?
I don't think you can, Your Honor, especially because saying that there's a lack of jurisdiction means there's a lack of power to adjudicate or adjudicate on the merits. And I think also I agree in general that it seems that the purpose of the Anti-SLAPP Act is to deter frivolous lawsuits, not meritorious lawsuits that are merely brought in
I
the
mean,
wrong
it seems
place.
like it's doubly frivolous if it's both not meritorious and filed in the wrong court. Well, it seems like you're saying that we should, the act imagines rewarding people for filing in the wrong court by protecting them from the attorney's fees that they might otherwise have to pay if they had filed in the right court.
Again, on the assumption that we are, that we do find that the special motion dismissed does apply, and the question is like whether a non-merits dismissal qualifies. I don't think that a case that is meritorious in terms of the actual claims that it's making, but is simply in the wrong place, is doubly frivolous, at
But
least
you
in
would
terms
agree
of
that you would agree a plaintiff is unlikely to succeed on the merits if they file in a court with no jurisdiction.
I just don't think filing in a court in the wrong jurisdiction has any relation to the underlying merits of the case and the
Well, in
purpose
order to
of the
succeed
Anti-SLAPP
on the
Act.
merits, you have to find a court with jurisdiction. So if you haven't found a court with jurisdiction, you're unlikely to succeed on the merits.
Well, I think the question is if there is any court that has jurisdiction. I mean, certainly if it could be brought somewhere else, it's not unlikely to succeed on the merits. I just didn't think that the question of merits goes to jurisdiction at all.
You're reading likelihood of success on the merits to mean doesn't is dis, not dismissible under Rule 12b-6.
Well, again,
Right.
I think that's yes. I think likelihood to succeed on the merits is similar to a Rule B6 standard, but again,
Possible reading, but it's not an obvious reading. Success on the merits could fail for merits reasons or lack of jurisdiction.
It's possible, Your Honor. And again, that's again why our fundamental position is that 5502 is cannot apply in federal court. And because again, fees are only available for a successful motion under 5502, regardless of the sort of basis of the dismissal, it just is not the fees are not available.
Is it the case that when the Supreme Court considers likelihood of success on the merits in the context of a stay motion, that even if the movant is guaranteed to win on the merits below, that at least some justices had said that that movant would not meet the standard for likelihood of success in the merits if the case is it's not cert worthy?
I hadn't thought of that. So the question is like if a case is likely to succeed but not cert worthy, would it be proper to say that it is it's not likely to succeed on the merits?
Would it be proper for the Supreme Court to say, in the context of the stay motion, that the movant has not demonstrated likelihood of success on the merits?
Because it's not cert worthy.
I thought that's what Justice Barrett had written in Doe's v. Mills, and I thought that Justice Kavanaugh had written the same thing in Labrador v. Poe a year or two later. I'm not sure any of the justices have written in disagreement with that.
That does seem right, Your Honor.
And if that's right, then that would suggest that there are more things that can affect likelihood of success on the merits than who is correct about about liability, I guess. Who is correct about the things we would argue about in a 12b6 motion?
That does seem right, Your Honor. I think the distinction I would again point to is that a lack of personal jurisdiction goes to the court's power to grant relief.
Appreciate that.
Do my colleagues have any other questions? Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ertelak. Let's see, we're back to Mr. Nathan for rebuttal on the cross appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to make one quick point addressing some of the questions raised by Judge Walker about how the answer the same question and the severability analysis interact here. There is no severability clause we're not relying on a DC law severability clause here. The severability principles come from two places. They come from the Rules Enabling Act, which contains its own limitation on the preemptive scope of even a valid federal rule that it shouldn't enlarge, modify, et cetera, any substantive right. It also comes from the Supreme Court's precedents and this court's precedents on how you limit the scope of the question, so to speak, that's being answered. Of course, if you let the sort of answer the same question standard sweep as broadly as, the literal language of that phrase says it could. Well, sometimes the questions could be defined at the highest possible level of generality, could be very, very broad, and suddenly a whole swath of state law are preempted by federal rules that are actually quite narrowly targeted to particular situations. So this court actually has a case post Shady Grove applying the answer the same question standard to the interaction between a federal rule of evidence and a DC law. That's Burke versus Air Service. And at 685 Federal Reporter 3rd at 1108, you can see how the panel in that case applied the standard and held that because the two rules could operate alongside one another, the state rule was not preempted by the federal rule under the Shady Grove standard that the Supreme Court just reaffirmed in Bach versus Choi. So our submission is that that's exactly what the court
Is
needs to do here,
that
and
case
allow.
in the briefs?
Yes, it is.
Sorry, give me the name again.
It's Burke against, and I think it's Air Services, but the citation is 685 Federal Reporter 3rd, and the Penn site I was discussing is 1108. If you give me a moment, I can give you the page in the brief at which it appears.
Just want to make sure I can find it easily. It's in your
It's almost certainly in our response and
in your
opening.
red
Yes,
brief.
our red brief.
I have it, Burke. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. If the court has no further questions, I thank you for your time.
My colleagues? Okay. Thank you to both counsels for the very helpful arguments. The case is submitted.